Aaron's little girl is all grown up. She's running on the streets and beating people up. They were on TV, but they didn't stay. So let's talk now about Birds of Prey.
Welcome to Broken Wings, the unofficial Birds of Prey commentary podcast. My name is Matt Trinrex, and welcome to episode 4. How about that? This episode will be brought to you by an apology for being silent with the show for the past month or so. This is what happens when a show with no budget and that's created just out of fan love doesn't get any guests. I don't want to bore you guys with just superfluous podcasts of me talking about how much I love the show. So when I don't have a guest, I just don't do a show. That's what happens. But thankfully, we've got some new shows coming up. Some very nice people have been kind enough to give me an hour or so of their time and sit down with me and talk about the show. And first up in this new rotation is the awesomely talented Tim Everett, the guy who's got probably the best credit in all of Birds of Prey, Gotham Animation Supervisor. If you're working on a Batman show, you probably want that to be your credit. He's a very cool guy, so incredibly knowledgeable about the effects community. He's an indie filmmaker. He's also turns out to be a big Batman fan, which is cool. We get into that a little bit. Once I realized he was a Batman nerd, I was all about it. But he's awesome. He's got some really cool insight on the show. I think you're going to dig the interview. First, though, just a little housekeeping, guys. The Facebook, the Twitters, the iTunes reviews, please, please give them to me. I know a lot of people that I approach about being on the show are looking at the presence the show has in social network. So really, every single like on the Facebook page, every follow on Twitter, all of that stuff counts. So please, if you haven't done any of that yet, head on over to Facebook and Twitter, like us, follow us. Also, please review us on the iTunes store. That's always great. And if you have feedback, you can leave it on iTunes, or you can always contact me. I'm Hawk with an E over at the Broken Wings, or excuse me, birdsofpreyonline.com. You can also just send an email through the comments page of brokenwingspodcast.com, or just send it straight through to brokenwingspodcast@gmail.com, which is the bad free little email address that we have. So please, I'd love to hear what you guys think about the show. But now on to it, again with Tim Everett. Just as we start sitting down, this is a phone interview. Again, I think the quality is a lot better, and I was smart enough to record myself this time on my own microphone. So, you know, hopefully the quality is good enough for you guys to listen to and enjoy, and hope you do. So without further ado, here is my interview with the man, the myth, the legend, Tim Everett. But so basically, we're up and rolling here. Thank you for bearing with me in the sound problems we just had there.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, please. Happy to do it. Very glad that you could take the time.
Yeah.
Like I said in the email, you have the best credit in all of the IMDb for Birds of Prey with your Gotham animator there. But I really wanted to start a little bit earlier. Basically, it's kind of a broad question, I realize, but I imagine growing up, you probably didn't know that computer animation would be in your future. When did that become an option for you? Was it always, did you always have a showbiz bent, or were you looking at something else initially?
Well, no, I was, you know, I wasn't am, I'm a filmmaker.
Okay.
I had done a lot of live action filmmaking for a good 10 years, maybe 15 years before starting in computer animation. And, and the story was we had some effect we had to do in a movie I was making, and it was just too expensive to do optically and very hard, like a ghost effect. And just then computers and computer compositing and stuff like that had just started. And somebody said, well, you could just, for the price you're going to pay those optical guys, you could buy this computer, you could do it yourself. So it's like, okay, that sounds good. So we bought a computer and bought some software, and I learned it in order to, you know, get out of this film I was working on.
Sure.
And back then there were so few people that knew how it worked and who were doing it that, you know, people started calling and saying, hey, can you do this for me, can you do that for me? And you know, I was a filmmaker. I wasn't like a service house, or I'd never worked for anybody else, but it was so interesting, and the things people were asking me to do were so interesting that I just started doing computer animation. And also, you know, the projects were, you know, like studio projects and, you know, things like Batman and stuff. And it's like, you can't say no. They say, you want to
of course.
So this Batman film, and it's like, well, yes. You know, one thing led to another, and I spent, you know, 10 or 15 years in, about, you know, good 10, 12 years in computer animation and working for the studios and stuff like that. So it was a lot of fun. And, so, you know, life is like that. It takes twists and turns. You never know.
Yeah, it sounds like you kind of Forrest Gumped into it there. Like, you didn't really mean to, but all of a sudden...
No, complete accident. And there was just a small little group of guys who were doing it back then, and we called them the OGs, the original gangsters. And most of them are still around. You know, the people that worked on Babylon 5 and...
Oh, wow.
You know, what was it? Sequest. You know,
sure.
The early, like, television projects that were using computer animation, because film, you know, most movies were too cool for it. But then the studio started, you know, was getting really successful, and they started doing more stuff in features, and that's just how it turned out. You know, one thing led to the next.
That's crazy. What was the film, and what was the effect that first got you going? What were you guys trying to do?
We were doing a movie that had a ghost in it. And
okay.
The producers, the financier guys were like, can you do like an effect like in that, you know, Patrick Swayze movie with the ghost with all the little sparkles coming out? And it's like, yeah, sure. You know, and that required a lot of, you know, thought to make that happen. But, you know, to do it optically with hand animation, everything was like, you know, outrageously expensive. It would have cost more. This was like a little B film, you know, it would have cost more than the cost of the entire movie. But we managed to pull some stuff off in the computer, and they were off to the races. At that point, like say, just sort of went from one project to the next, and everything was more interesting than the thing you'd worked on before. And you know, filmmaking as a director fell by the wayside for me because I was, you know, kind of swept up in this other stuff.
Yeah, sure. Well, before we get to the other stuff, about the directing, when did that start for you? Did you go to film school or?
Yeah, I went to USC.
Oh, okay.
And when I graduated, the thing about USC is they brainwash you into thinking if you graduate and you take a job, it's a sign of failure. Because
money is a sign of failure usually.
Because filmmakers don't have jobs. Filmmakers just make films. They have financiers and.
I see.
Distribution arrangements, but they don't have a job. You know, there's no Craigslist that says, you know, need a movie director, you know, up here. It doesn't happen. So I got out and started a little production company and, you know, tried to get clients and tried to raise money and do that. It took a few years to break in, you know, did commercials and industrials for a few years.
Oh, I imagine, yeah.
Yeah, and then started doing like little B films and stuff like that. And then took this left turn into computer animation.
Now, since then, obviously you've had a great, outstanding career in computer animation. Have you gone back to film in the directing side?
Yes, that's what I'm trying to do now, because the visual effects industry in Los Angeles has kind of collapsed. And
I've heard people say that, yeah.
Yeah, it's really bad. You know, if you go to a VFX soldier, who's a guy who's really advocating, trying to keep the jobs in Hollywood, you see how bad it is. You know, Digital Domain went bankrupt. Rhythm and Hues went bankrupt. All these little boutique shops, you know, there's one going out of business every couple of weeks.
Sure.
And there's great, great guys on the streets in L.A. right now who are having a hard time finding work.
Is that just because, I mean, obviously visual effects are not slowing down in movies. Are they just moving out of L.A.?
Moving out of L.A. because foreign countries and different states around the U.S. Offer tax incentives. So if you go to Vancouver, they'll give you, you know, 2/3, like 60% or so, I forget what the number is, it's really enormous, of your money back for every dollar you spend there, you get it back as a tax break or as a cash rebate.
Oh, so it's just like filming out of state or out of the country.
Yeah, and, okay. And in Vancouver, I remember a friend of mine did car commercials, and it used to be that they got these tax rebates to shoot there, and he was spending, you know, 10 months out of the year away from his wife and his nice little house shooting up in Vancouver. And then I remember when the post-production started there, because they just shot there, but then he wasn't even coming back. It's like, no, now he would always come back and edit and do all the post for his little car commercials. And then they started doing all the post up there, and this enormous, you know, post-production industry started. And now a lot of the visual effects supervisors that I know from LA, you know, they come up and live out of a suitcase in Vancouver for 6 months out of the year.
For however long they have to, I guess, to support.
Yeah, think about if you're a producer and you've got $1 million to spend, and if you spend it in LA, it's gone. And if you spend it in Vancouver, they write you a check for $500,000 or more back when you're finished. Or in some of these other foreign countries, you can get as much as 90% of your money back.
Jesus.
And, you know, it's a dollar. It's a bottom line. And you can't blame them. You can't say, well, that. It's like, no, that's just economics.
No, you can't argue that it doesn't make sense. But just as a fan, and I'm sure as a creator yourself, like it must be hard to see it happen.
Yeah, well, it is. But and also because of the sophistication of the internet these days, where you can have shots farmed out to China and to India and all these places, where, you know, you can't knock how brilliant, you know, software engineers are in India. You know, I mean, sure. They are brilliant. And so you can get this great work from really smart guys, you know, in computers. And, you know, you upload it to your FTP, and there it is in the morning. And you can, you know, have this software where you can talk to them and give notes. And so it almost doesn't matter where you are anymore. It's really just economics. And some of these places like China and stuff, you know, they pay the people, you know, a dollar a day in a bowl of rice. And you've got to compare that to, you know, a good, you know, solid effects artist in LA who's making, you know, a cool six figures.
Sure. And trying to maintain in LA, which is not a cheap thing.
No. And even the guy who made Gravity, the visual effects supervisor of Gravity, somebody hassled him and around the time of the Academy Awards and said, you know, how come you went overseas for all your work and what's going on? How come you didn't do some of it in L.A.? And he said, yeah, well, the problem with L.A. is the guys there, they're just not young and hungry enough. And it's like, ooh, ouch, oh, I'm an old-timer and I really like to make money. I don't want to just do it really cheap. So, you know, that's just the attitude right now. So it's really troubling for the visual effects industry. I'm saying there's a lot of guys with brilliant reels. I mean, brilliant reels that are, you know, looking for work. And it's just, it should be that way. When I was seriously into it, because I left town a few years ago because I had a crystal ball. And, but when I was seriously into it, I was never unemployed a day in my life because, you know, one project, you'd finish a project on a Friday, you'd start another one on a Monday. It was just so much work, and it was so good, and it paid so well, you know, it was just really terrific. But it's harder now, you know. I've got a couple of my friends that are still doing okay, but I know a lot of other guys that have been, like, unemployed for 2 years, and it's just, it's okay. It's, you know, it's tragic. It's tragic. And I don't know how Hollywood's going to bounce back, because they're fighting tax incentives, so they're saying, let's give tax incentives to Hollywood. And you have to say that to politicians, right? And politicians have to justify that to voters and people who are low-information voters. They go, oh, tax breaks to the movie studios and to Tom Cruise, and he's going to keep more money, you know, not pay taxes. It's like, no, that's not it. It's the workers that you know, the day-to-day guys who are raising families, those are the guys who are going to benefit. Tom doesn't get a tax break. But the optics are so bad that they just won't go for it. It's just crazy. It's like, tax breaks to Warner Brothers. It's not going to happen. You know?
Yeah, that just sounds like people not seeing the industry behind Tom Cruise or Warner Brothers or, you know, whatever the case may be.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, it's a hard thing. So so I'm back to trying to make films and stuff like that, and doing less visual effects work up here in Seattle. Certainly fewer movies, more commercials and things. But I'm also trying to get projects off the ground, and that's fun.
I bet that's exciting. I mean, sounds like a new turn in the career after the busy effects work down here. I mean, like you said, looking at your IMDb page, it does seem like you just went from one thing to another, like you had your hand in so many things. I mean, Pirates 3, Last Samurai, Blood Diamond. You've worked with Ed Zwick a lot?
Yeah. Ed Zwick is great.
Yeah, I used to intern for him for a couple months, which is funny. But yeah, no, I used to, I was a big Last Samurai fan, so always cool to be in those offices. And you worked on that film, right?
Yeah. I was an animation supervisor on that film, and we did. I built the little army guys and the little samurai guys and the horses and
oh wow
sort of thing. And there's quite a bit of CG stuff in the movie. Although if you listen to the audio commentary on the DVDs, Whit goes, and we did everything live because he has such a chip on his shoulder because Return of the King had just come out and it was all CG, and he was like, no, we did everything live, but there's a lot of CG in that movie.
Yeah, but less wizards and elephants, so it's yeah. Just yeah, understood. But I mean, like that's a large scale project, a lot of them are. So where was there a moment where you felt like, oh, I've made it now. Like this is what I'm doing now. Was there one project that you felt like, okay, this will be the turning point for me in the animation realm? Or did it just seem like it just kind of kept happening and they just kept getting marginally bigger and bigger?
It was just, you just sort of went from one thing to the next and didn't know what was going to happen tomorrow. I mean, the film industry, is it's a very uncertain thing. You don't know.
Sure.
But at least when you're working consistently and there's always one job following another, you feel good about that. But there was always like bigger guys in town. I was not one of the big guys. There's people like Douglas Trumbull walking around.
Sure.
And I'm just a humble film worker. My friends are like grips and stuff like that. We're just like the guys in the trenches that are lifting the boxes.
You're being humble, but your IMDb page reads a little bit differently, I have to say.
Seriously, there's giants out there,
Oh, for sure, but it sounds like you scraped out a nice little corner for yourself at the time as well.
Yeah. No, it was fun, because it's fun to get a call from, Disney, and they're like, come up and tell us if you think this can be done, and you get to go to a big meeting, and there's people there around the table that have Academy Awards and stuff, and they're like looking at you, and it's like, yeah, sure.
Why not?
We can do that.
What did you do with Disney?
We did movies like The Guardian with Kevin Costner.
Oh, that was Disney produced? Excuse me.
That was a Disney film.
I didn't realize that.
And that was an interesting one because I did some early tests of the hurricane sequences.
Yes.
The deal was the movie wasn't going to be greenlit unless, we could prove that it could be done.
Wow. So no pressure.
Yeah. With all these guys with Academy Awards staring at you, and they're like, well, can it be done? And it's like the whole thing, the whole project depends on the right answer. It's like, you bet. Standards were high. Their standards were really high. The guy who was the head of post-production at Disney, he goes, yeah, did you see Perfect Storm? And it's like, yeah. And he goes, hated it. It was awful. And it's like, oh, yeah, you're right. He goes, did you see Day After Tomorrow, that wave hitting the Statue of Liberty? And I'm like, oh, yeah. And he goes, that was awful. And it's like, oh, yeah, you're right, man. You better than that. It's like, God, what are they talking about, That's true.
It sounds like one of those things where, like, when the actor is asked to if he can ride a horse, you say yes, and then you take lessons after the audition.
Yeah.
Yeah?
They sat down and just this footage that they'd shot around Cape Horn for Master and Commander of a real hurricane. These, you know, sat at the screening room with this gigantic screen, you know, with these giant waves of water coming up with all this micro detail. And they're like, and the guy when he's working with me goes, intimidating, isn't it? So yeah.
Just a tad. Just a tad.
So anyway, yeah.
Looking at your career here too, you've done a lot of film, and it seems like obviously Birds of Prey brings us here a lot of TV too. Do you prefer one or the other? Do you feel like one gives you more control, or is it just you know, any medium will do?
You have, well, yeah, it doesn't matter to me, but you have more time on film. You're all, you know, sometimes on a film you'll have like as 7 or 8 months to accomplish something, where in TV it's like you've got till Friday, and then you've got till Friday again, and then you've got till Friday again, and the deadlines come really fast, and you've just got to deliver a lot really, really, really quick. So that's the difference.
So that sounds like film has a little more luxury in the timing aspect then.
Right. But Birds of Prey, because we were doing, speaking of Birds of Prey, because we were doing the effects that were going to be used sort of throughout the first season, like Wayne Manor and Gotham City and the Bell Tower and stuff, we had a decent amount of lead time to accomplish all that. In other words, it wasn't like just like Babylon 5 where it's like episodic and every week you got to deliver, you know, 20 shots. This was like more of building like a library of stuff that was going to be reused, and so we had a decent amount of time. So it depends on the project.
Well, yeah, that was a question I had, because, you know, like you said, a lot of the effects that they established right away in the pilot did get reused kind of episode after episode, especially the establishing, like, swoops through the city. So was that all, that was all you guys in the pilot, or did you stay on with the show for a couple episodes after, or?
I seem to remember we did a little bit of work after the pilot, but it was... it occurred to me, and I wasn't involved in this part of it, but it occurred to me that the budget got really tight.
I've heard that as well, yeah.
And they were explaining to us, it's like, well, you know, we had originally budgeted to do more original stuff through the season, but right now we're like cutting back, and we're just going to like reuse a lot of the shots and stuff like that. So I seem to remember on our end it went away pretty fast. But we did have a little decent amount of time to build for the pilot, and I really actually liked the show. I liked the casting, and I liked the whole little universe they were trying to create. And you know, I wished it had gone on a little more, personally.
Oh, me too. I mean, I was 12 years old at the time, and like a big Batman fan, so it grabbed me, you know, right away.
Yeah, kind of in the hot corner of the Batman universe too.
It is, and it's one that. Well, that's why I'm here. One that not many people usually talk about or remember. So
right, they're all because video games are all into Arkham and stuff like that. And
yeah, now that's doing well, incredibly well, obviously.
Movie's going to go toward the Arkham stories.
Mm-hmm.
But I did like the this particular little corner. I thought it was nice.
Always glad to hear that somebody who worked on it was into it. Now you had mentioned I think I saw you were working at, correct me if I'm wrong, Flashworks at the time?
Flash Filmworks,
excuse me. And they had done effects, I think, for just Batman and Robin and the OnStar commercials. Were you involved with those before Birds?
I believe that I met Bill Mesa, who was the owner of Flash. I think I met him and was working for him right at the Batman and Robin phase.
Okay.
And then I did some of the shots on the OnStar commercials. Yeah, I did, and I think they got the OnStar because a lot of like gargoyles and things had been made for Batman and Robin, and you know, we had to do like a Gotham City in there, and it kind of had to match, you know, this kind of Batman universe, and so we had a lot of digital assets that were already built,
which I imagine is why they turned you to Flash Filmworks and you guys for Birds of Prey too.
Probably. Yeah.
In that, do you remember, were there, when designing the city that was used in the show, were there any assets from those other projects that were brought over to it, or was it kind of a ground up situation? And again, I apologize for asking you about a project 10 years later.
No, there were quite a few, but all the city establishers we were doing for Birds of Prey were much sort of like bigger and more comprehensive and full CG, because Batman and Robin included a lot of miniature stuff and like old fiction sort of effects work. That was sort of like the hinge of when CG was really starting to come into feature filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, before that, it really was a lot of miniature work. And Bill Mesa, who was the owner of Flash, he was an old guy from way back who had done like Outland. Remember Outland with Sean Connery?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I remember that famous picture of him in the onesie there.
Yeah, and all those sort of like the establishing shots in Outland that looked like oil rigs and stuff. These were all built. These were all miniatures built with little wheat lights and everything. And Bill had done all that stuff. He
wow.
built those things and, you know, filmed them. And he was, you know, really huge in that field. And also he had a company called Intervision, which did front projection, which worked on like every movie you've ever heard of. I'm serious, through the 60s and 70s and stuff. It's like, it's ridiculous. But they had a really brilliant way to composite, you know, sort of like in the camera with front projection. I believe that he got a Technical Academy Award for it.
Oh, wow. Front projection in front of a matte painting, I guess?
Well, your actors... In traditional front projection, there's a kind of a 45-degree angle piece of glass in front of the camera,
mm-hmm.
and you project onto that, and then it projects over the actor and onto a big piece of shiny, like, Mylar. And
okay.
And so it's all, like, lined up perfectly, and the actor actually, he covers up his own shadow on that screen, so it has to be just, like, perfectly... done.
Oh,
Bill invented a system where it's all these little interlocking boxes and stuff, and I can't even describe it. It's so complicated, but you got a really good result. You know, better than any kind of like rear or front screen projection ever before. So this little company, Intervision, did a lot of work in its heyday. But then, you know, computers were invented, and that all went away, and Intervision collapsed because that's
wow.
what they did. So Bill started Flash Filmworks, and, you know, like I say, but he was a great miniature guy, so he knew lots of stuff about how to make things look right in scale, you know.
Now, did Flash Filmworks make a lot of the miniatures at the time for things like Batman and Robin and whatnot, or were they supplied by the studios?
I believe they did.
Oh, wow.
You know, Bill's brother Johnny was like quite a little miniature guy back in the day. And I'll say by the time I was involved with these guys, all that had gone away.
Right.
Or is it the very end of it? I never saw any of it. But they were great at it. And so they had a real great sense of, you know, how to create scale and how to create depth and all these things from having worked in physical effects for so long. So they were, you know, very... you know, brilliant about how to integrate CG in the movies, where other people's work at the time was like really like kind of crappy and obvious.
Yeah.
These guys were old timers. They knew what the hell they were doing.
It certainly showed. Well, yeah, no, I'm a bit of a, I work at a place called Prop Store where we sell movie props and costumes and whatnot. And every once in a while we'll get in a miniature piece from, well, we've had some from some of the Batman movies, but even Star Wars and things like that. And it's just like, it's amazing the detail and the thought that must have been gone into that, you know, and then into thinking of how it would wind up being in the camera. It's just, like you said, it's brilliant work.
Right. When you think about like Blade Runner and Close Encounters of the Third Kind,
mm-hmm.
and that stuff was all done with miniatures.
And it still looks phenomenal.
Yeah, it's and it holds up. You know, like Blade Runner, the effects hold up. It's like, that's really good.
Yeah. It's a classic for a reason, for sure.
Lots of movies these days that, you know, the CG is, like, painfully obvious. It's like, man, it's not even as good as they were in the 60s, man.
Well, yeah, not being in the game anymore. Are you seeing movies and just rolling your eyes, I guess?
Not too many because, you know, I'm not seeing too many of the small films, but, you know, I will get out to see, you know, like, big impressive movies. But and some of them are really good, like the first Sherlock Holmes movie with Robert Jr. was had some astounding, you know, London establishers, you know, where you just look at that and go, oh my God, that took a long time. Look at how great that is, you know. So yeah, there's some really good work being done. Not, you know, all in London and Taiwan.
Yeah, well, there's that, but
bummer.
But it's all looking good. Well, cool. Back to Birds of Prey for a second, if you don't mind. I'm sorry. Out of curiosity, obviously it's related to the Batman universe. WB was very protective of Batman and still is. Were there any directives sent directly to you guys from the higher-ups, from either the producers or the studio, about how to design it or how to treat it? Or at that point, was it trusted that Flash Filmworks and you guys knew what was going on?
Okay, I'll tell you a hilarious story. This is the truth. We sat down and, you know, we had to do Gotham City and everything and stuff like that and all these big establishers. And the guy who was in charge of it all, of the art direction and everything, he sat down and you got one of those weird directions that you never like to hear. He goes, it has to look absolutely photoreal, but also very cartoony. You know, very stylized, like a comic book, like a real cartoon, but also extremely realistic. You know, it's like, oh, good, black and white. You know,
oh God.
You know, and it's just like, oh my God, are you serious? And they were dead serious. You know, and so here's the story. So I thought, how the hell am I going to do that? And I thought, well, what we'll try to do is I will build Gotham City in, you know, as much detail as we possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
And texture it as realistically as I can under the circumstances. But what I will do is I will paint mad skies. And so the skies that I painted were, you know, orange and red, these like sunset crazy clouds and everything, and then the cities with these wild colors. And so if you really look at the cities, the, you know, the bricks look right and all that chrome and all this stuff, it all looks pretty
sure.
Good, but it's the lighting from the sky that just makes it so ultra stylized. So you've got those sunset shots and some day shots that are blue and everything. It's like this cold blue stuff. And the night shots have this like purple clouds. It's like, well, what's night for a comic book? It's purple clouds.
Purple. Yeah, that's amazing that you said that. I'd never really noticed that, but you're right. Even the days always looked like no matter what time it was in sunset, you know, like,
yeah. But I think there was like a big blue one too, that had like blue.
There was. Yeah. This just shows you how much I've watched the show in the past 10 years, but yeah, no, I do remember that.
So that was my attempt to, you know, the cartoony stuff was more like the skies and the lighting, you know, there's these intense colors, these intense saturated, crazy, oranges and reds and things. And then the rest of the city's supposed to, you know, within that sort of feel, was supposed to be more real. And then the funny thing was that the very first test I did, I had painted this absolutely, you know, like hand painted these clouds, you know, like matte painting,
mm-hmm.
And had done this absolutely insane sky. I was so proud of it. I wish I had this image. I wish I had this painting still. I've lost it over the years, but the skies were like, the clouds were so multicolored. I mean, there were green, you know, parts of the clouds and purple.
Oh, wow.
And crazy and they folded in on each other and they were, you know, I had so much crazy detail and it was so dramatic. And the director came by and he looked at it. He looked at the first thing and he goes, "My God, man, there's more drama in those clouds than in my entire movie." That's a true story. And I'm like, oh, is that good? He goes, no, dude, you got to tone it down. He goes, that's way over the top. You know, it's like, damn. I thought it was great. That was absolutely fantastic.
It sounds awesome, yeah.
What you see is the toned down version.
The
original thing, but I'll never forget that quote.
And see, if they hadn't put you on the leash, we'd still have, it'd be in season 10 now, you watch.
Yes.
You're right.
I wonder what he meant by that. but that was the approach, so that's how we got cartoony and real.
Oh, wow. Well, it worked. It always had that Tim Burton element of hyper-realism, you know, and the comic book element, too. But it's funny that that's how you guys broke it down. Were you at that point involved too in designing any of the main buildings that you see? I know that you did establishing shots for the clock tower and the high school and the police station. Were those designs sent over, or did you guys come up with those?
No, the clock tower I pretty much did. I mean, basically we knew there had to be a clock tower, and it had to have this sort of, period New York feel to it.
Sure.
So, I can't remember. I think it was like kitbashed out of a lot of little pieces and designed, but I believe that I did the clock tower.
Oh, that's so cool. I love that clock tower design. That's awesome.
I remember working really hard on that. And I think we had some interior reference of what it looked like from the inside,
mm-hmm.
which had been built as the set.
Right.
And so I had that, so I knew how big the, like the clock was and how the roof was slanted and stuff like that. But the
windows on the side and stuff, yeah.
The rest of all the exterior was just, we pulled out of our hat.
Oh, that's so cool. I have had that, or images of that, as the background of my computer more times than not. That's awesome.
It's hilarious.
Oh, it's such a beautiful design.
Yeah. No, that's the stuff you just come up with when you're forced to sit down and do something. And I seem to remember that Wayne Manor was put together the same way, and I didn't do Wayne Manor. A guy named Mark Kaczynski did that.
There was a Wayne Manor shot? I don't honestly think that ever made it into the show.
Well, I remember that it was a real struggle, and the visual effects supervisor really had a hard time getting the Wayne Manor environment right. But I remember Mark working on it really hard, and he, because they kind of left it to us how all this stuff looked. We didn't get like concept art from the art directors and stuff like that.
Right.
It was just kind of like, yeah, there's got to be a Wayne Manor. It's like, okay,
Oh my God. I wonder if there's a cut of the show that has that in that somewhere. I've never seen a Wayne Manor in Birds of Prey. I bet that was awesome.
Yeah, I can't remember because I seem to remember in the pilot, at least the version that I saw when they were doing the cut, that it was there, but it might have finally gotten cut out. It could be that they finally didn't like it, because I know it was really hard for them to sign off on what Mark was doing, but I thought he was doing a good job. I thought it was really neat, but maybe it wasn't my thing, so maybe it was, not respecting enough of the established...
Something from the movies or whatever?
Or something. Maybe their expectations were a little different from what Mark was doing, but...
Oh, wow.
But it was actually pretty cool. I mean, it was neat to be, walking through the room and seeing somebody making Wayne Manor.
Yeah, how could it not be?
Yeah, how could it not be?
Are you a comics fan? Were you a fan of the Batman, the story or the mythos? Or
Dude, I was a kid, And,
sure.
Yeah, and Batman was my favorite of all comic book characters. I liked him the most because... I remember telling people back when I was 8, 9 years old that the reason I liked Batman is he technically didn't actually have any superpowers.
No, he's just a very determined dude.
Yeah, and in the early comic books in the 60s, the ones that I was collecting,
mm-hmm.
They were still detective comics.
Yeah.
And he was just a, kind of a mad detective.
The Dark Knight detective, sure.
Always had to solve the crime. His whole thing was solving the crimes and stuff like that, and figuring things out, and he had a little utility belt, he had little chemicals in that he'd take with him, and it was like, it was all very cool, as opposed to Superman, who could just, melt things with his eyes, or, fly around the earth backwards, and time would reverse.
Yeah, be a god, essentially.
Like, yeah, he could do anything, where and had to figure things out, had to have little grappling hooks and ropes and things with them to stuff. And
wait, so you're collecting comics in the 60s then?
Yeah, man, I was collecting comics in the 60s.
What was your reaction to Adam West then?
Well, I was the right age for that.
Okay.
That was the age when, you know, the Monkees were on the air, you know.
Sure.
And Adam West and that Biff Pow stuff. It was like, I thought it was fantastic, you know.
Yeah.
I was totally the right age to love that stuff. I was, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 years old when that stuff was on.
Oh, okay. That is the perfect age then.
Yeah. So it was wonderful. I mean, you look back on it now, maybe it's a little crazy, but you know, I still
love it. But I think I was like, you know, my parents grew up on it that much like you as well. So when I was a kid and had seen a few Batman things, they turned me onto that. And I was young enough to not really get it, you know?
I was much more disturbed by the Tim Burton Batman, you know?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a big jump, yeah.
Which is too weird for me. It's like, come on, you know, that's why I like the Dark Knight reboot, you know, because it's like, wow, now we've got, like, you know, more of a realistic kind of, you know, the Miller version, you know?
Yeah.
When that came out, I was like, oh, somebody's actually taking Batman seriously. So I loved the Frank Miller version. And was excited when people started respecting that in the movies. Oh, to a little bit. I wish they'd do more Frank Miller. They should let him and Rodriguez make a Batman movie.
Oh, that'd be amazing.
Wouldn't it be great? I mean, I like what they're doing now, but it would just be a different thing, you know.
It would be nice for someone who actually had a hand in the comics to actually jump in and do it. Yeah, no, I completely agree. Hopefully we'll get a little Miller, though, with Batman vs. Superman, or whatever they're calling it now. But
The Sin City version of Batman, you know?
The what?
The Sin City version of Batman.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But we'll see. You know, they're not doing a bad job. I like what they're doing right now.
Yeah, for sure. We'll see what Ben Affleck does and go from there.
Oh, okay. We'll talk later.
Yeah, we'll do a little commentary after that, because the world will have to know our opinions.
Oh my god.
Well, that sounds awesome. Okay, last Birds of Prey question for you, and then I will let you enjoy your night, I promise you. Were you involved? I've read a few scripts from the series. I haven't been able to get a hold of the pilot, but some of the later scripts, they call it bat camming through the city for the establishing shot. Was that how it was directed towards you to do, or did you guys come up with that and the writers adapt it? Where did that idea of just kind of flying through the buildings like that come from?
I'm pretty sure, I can't remember. I'm pretty sure that they asked for it.
Okay.
You know, the shots that I still have on my reel, actually, because I still love showing some of that stuff, are more of the slower, big establishing shots, but I do seem to remember there were some faster swoopy moves once everything was built that were filmed out.
Yep.
Yeah.
But some of the slower establishing shots for like the clock tower or whatever or more.
Yeah, there was one shot that was like massive push from the entire city, like right into the face of the clock tower.
Yeah, they reused that over and over again in the show. And that was one of the day shots, sure.
Yeah.
Well, very cool. So going back into directing now, and obviously coming from directing to begin with, do you feel like animation in the middle has helped you express something more as a director, or has one part of the career fed another, or?
Well, I've been trying to get a big visual effects movie off the ground for many years, but gosh, you need a lot of money for that sort of thing.
I bet.
And most of the stuff I've been doing lately in the last 10 years have been, you know, like small personal films. Because the way my career started before animation was, you know, we were trying to get into the studios, we were trying to work with stars, and we were trying to get, you know, bigger budgets, and we were
sure.
doing like little action movies, you know, we'd have machine gun battles and chases and flip cars, and we got into all those physical stunts, man. I'm telling you, I knew the L.A. stunt underground like nobody's business. Really, I mean, we knew everybody, and it was so much fun. But no, lately, you know, we've just been doing like little personal projects, you know, like little like coming of age movies and things like that.
Sure.
Because you know, sort of got over the you know, we'll impress Hollywood with how much production value we can put together, and that is less important to me now. Now it's all like, well, I wonder if I can make a movie that just beginning to end has like fantastic acting, you know, just really real, so it has a sense of reality to it, and that's what we're going for right now with the little team that I'm working with is we just want reality, you know, things to just be absolutely clean and perfect and real, and that's the most important part. So, and we're working with little lower budgets too. But the great thing about the day we're living in right now is the digital production, because
sure,
you can get your hands on a camera that, you know, 5 years ago had the dynamic range that was needed for movies and, you know, could make decent movies, and now you can pick those cameras up for nothing. And you can shoot all day long for nothing. And it's really just putting a great cast together and having a really good script. And the rest of the production becomes, you know, extremely doable. And that's a beautiful thing for people that want to make independent film. I mean, I think it's we're going to reaching a point where we're going to hit a golden age of independent film because of how simple it's now become to really put a, you know, first-class image together, first-class shooting together.
The technology at people's fingertips?
Yeah, it's so simple, and it's advancing rapidly, faster than you can imagine. The quality of the cameras and the codecs that you work with and the post-production pipeline, it just gets better and easier and, you know, every day. So that accrues to our benefit. You know, in other words, we don't need you know, $10 or $15 million just for the physical production anymore. Now it's like, well, you need a good cast, and the rest of it's pretty simple and easy to do. So it's all up to, you know, script and actors and coming up with stuff like that.
And are you doing your own scripts or developing scripts with writers? Or
yes.
Yes to all. Cool.
Yeah.
Well, excellent. Is there any movie or project on the horizon that people should know about? Or,
well, there's one that we hope gets done this year that we've my partner and I just finished the script on, and it's called Nimbus Frick Thinks He's Something, and it's a comedy.
I think I saw, is there a poster for that on your website, I think?
There is a poster on the website.
Yep. Okay.
And it's kind of a, you know, romantic comedy, you know, Cassavetes style independent film with a lot of humor in it. But, you know, I say something that's extremely real. That's what we're trying to go for right now.
Oh, that's exciting. So the script is done and now hopefully move forward?
Raising money. And the only thing is we want like a massive, great cast. So, you know, we're looking for, you know, several million dollars just for the cast. We want to get really, 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 really good people in it.
Oh, wow.
Then we'll be happy, because it's all about the cast. It's everything's about the cast.
Absolutely.
What was the movie I was watching the other night? Oh my God. The one about the ab scam. That have Christian Bale in it.
Oh, American Hustle?
Yeah, American Hustle.
Yes.
It was like awesome. That's like the perfect independent film. You know, you've got...
Yep, loved it as well.
Yeah, really, really good actors, you know, bringing such reality to what they're doing. You know, great story, beautifully told. You know, it's just, you know, that to me right now is the mark to hit. Make a movie like that. So I'm much more into that really than I am like making a big science fiction movie like Gravity, you know.
Sure.
Which is like astounding to watch, but you know, but then in the end it's like, and she got home.
And then she went in the water and hit the beach, and that was about it.
Fade out. Yep. It's like, you know, beautiful, you know, totally entertaining, but we're going for the human drama right now. That's my thing.
Awesome.
There we go.
Well, the best of luck to you and the project, and hopefully hear some some great things from that coming up in the future.
Yeah, we hope so too. But the thing that I discovered just in the side of the story is we made a little independent film about 6 years ago. And being a visual effects guy, it was like, oh, well, we'll do all the driving shots, green screen, you know, we'll slam these together. And there was a lot of day for night, or some like night shots. Like, well, shooting day for night, I'll like, you know, comp them up and put some stars in the sky and everything. In the end, the movie had like 250 effect shots in it. Was like, and it didn't seem like a lot, because that's not a lot for a movie these days. Any little movie has that many effect shots in it these days.
Sure.
But still, you get to the point where you've got to finally do them. And it's like, yeah, we got the cut and we're ready to do the effects. It's like, oh my God, I've got like 8 months of work to do.
Yeah.
This is enormous. So.
But at least you get to stretch those skills too. It sounds like you're not bored. So that's good.
No. There's lots to do. And I don't know. I love the idea of the future of film. You know, I love the advances in technology. Speaking of Douglas Trumbull, he's just premiering a 4K, 3D, 120 frame system on May 11th up here in Seattle.
Oh, really?
And he's made a little science fiction movie, a little short to demo it. And it's supposed to be like so incredibly ridiculously immersive, because it's so incredibly high res and such a high frame rate and all in 3D. And yet it's all just projected on regular digital projectors. You just got to tweak them, you know,
sure.
And do the right thing. And it's like, I'm so optimistic about the technology of film and how fast it's advancing. You know, they have 4K TVs now. It's like, do you need a 4K TV? It's like, I don't know.
No.
Well, you think not, but wait till they start making, you know, 4K 120 frame per second movies, and you're going to go, I need that in my home theater.
Fair enough, but for right now, with like watching Hell's Kitchen or whatever, I don't think you.
It's going to change the world. I'm saying the world's changing really fast, and it's very exciting. It's very exciting. That's the one thing about my background that I enjoy, is that I've got such was so immersed in all the technical stuff.
Sure.
And like high-end computer technical stuff, but all this new stuff is happening. It's like I just dig it so much. I'm really enjoying where it's all going, and wildly optimistic that there's going to be some really stuff that will blow your mind you've never seen before is coming out. It's going to be coming up in the next 10 years. Just wait and see.
I'm going to hold you to that, though, if it doesn't.
I'm certain of it.
Okay. Oh, wow.
So anyway, so that's my last word. My last optimistic word about the film industry is it's just going to get better. You know, I mean, you look at Gravity, it's like, that's amazing. You know, there wasn't a cut for 20 minutes, just this huge technological extravaganza. And yet you can do it. You can do it, you know, so you're going to see more cool stuff. And I have hope for it.
Well, hopefully more cool stuff from you too, Tim. It sounds great. Again, hopefully this new project gets going, and I can't wait to see it if it does.
Yeah, man.
Well, cool. Well, yeah, I don't want to keep taking up any more of your time, but we'll probably end the podcast right around here. But thank you again so much for taking the time and reminiscing with me and talking about the future and some comics and stuff. I really appreciate it, man.
And thanks for loving the Batman universe, because you know, that's going to evolve too. That's not going away. It's that's as strong as ever. So
oh no, 75 years and counting, man. Let's go.
Yeah. So I'm optimistic about Batman and that whole thing. It's just, I think it's going to get more interesting.
Me too. It'll be interesting to see where we go after the Nolan series.
Yeah. Exactly.
Absolutely. Well, cool.
Well, keep me posted what you're doing and what you find out about all this stuff, because it sounds like you got your ear to the ground.
We'll do. And please, I mean, if there's ever anything I can promote on the Twitter or the Facebook or whatever about upcoming projects, feel free to give me an email, man.
Okay, I will absolutely do that.
All right, cool. Well, thank you very much, and enjoy your night, Tim. Nice talking with you.
Okay.
All right, bye now.
And there you have it, my interview with Tim Everett. It was just awesome. I can't thank him enough for taking the time to talk with me about the show, about his life, about his filmmaking, his thoughts on the business. I loved it all. Hope you guys like the insight he brought to Birds of Prey as well. I mean, this is the guy that built the clock tower. Who knew? I got so excited when he mentioned that. And then geeked out a little bit because I really do have the clock tower as the wallpaper of my computer more times than not in the past 10 years. So really cool to talk with him. Next time, though, watch out because we've got a new guest going to be another actor guest. The incredibly talented Christopher McNeely. That's right. Frankie Spitz himself took the time out of one of his nights to do a phone interview with me. Such an awesome guy, too. We talked a lot about theater. If you're a musical theater nerd like I am, you'll get a lot out of it. And he also had some great recollections about Birds of Prey, including the fact that he was on set when the word came down that they got canceled. So check out that interview next time it comes out, probably a few weeks from now. But I will let you guys know on the Twitters and the Facebooks and, of course, BrokenWingsPodcast.com. So till next time, thank you for listening. Feel free to give some feedback. Hope you enjoyed it. And remember, no matter what, the Oracle is watching.